Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Kimberly St. Julian Varnin, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Till Mostolansky about his new book, A Zaun on the Moon, Entangling Modernity Along Tajikistan's Pamir Highway. Till, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And so, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm an anthropologist. I work mostly on Central Asia, but also neighboring areas in Pakistan, Afghanistan, more recently also China. And in recent years, I've really extended my scope also to diasporic communities who come from the region but live far beyond these places in Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, and Central Asia more broadly. I've done work in Europe. I've lived and worked in Singapore and Hong Kong, where I also interacted with people from the region. I've come to see my field sites, I guess, in Central Asia as really part of a crossroads that provides people in the region itself with connections to very different places around the world. And what I'm passionate about in my work is to study these connections via a series of specific topics that I think can shed light on different dynamics that very strongly define these connections. And in this regard, I've over the past 10-15 years, I've looked at different topics in depth that I think also feature in the book and that we can talk about afterwards in more depth. Islam has certainly been one of these topics that I've looked at in depth over the past decade in particular. And I'm interested in the various resources that Muslim identity provides for people in Central Asia. A resource to connect, but at the same time also to distinguish themselves from people in other places. It's really an interest I've had since conducting research in Kyrgyzstan for my first book, which was about the legacy of Russian colonial and Soviet discourse on nomads in Kyrgyzstan. And there Islam has a particular place that I got interested in over the years. Another topic that I think is probably more important for the book that we're talking about is infrastructure. I'm interested in material networks, networks of built environment, of technology that link people in particular ways. And these networks are often emblematic for both the establishment and the decline of political rule. And I guess in the context of post-Soviet Central Asia, infrastructure has a very important meaning for people in everyday life as well. So this is a topic, especially infrastructure, and then sort of the link to Islam. They have been framing themes of my doctoral dissertation, And they sort of fed, really importantly also, into Azan on the Moon, where I'm interested in the contradictions of modernity that relates to infrastructure, Islam, people's identities on the ground, materiality, and really the afterlives of the Soviet Union along this highway.
And so thinking of all of these things, how did you come up with your title for the book, Azan on the Moon?
It's an interesting and very complex question that sometimes I tend to give a very short answer, which I think is right. And then there's a much longer answer, which comes with quite a bit of historical and theoretical baggage. Now, to start with sort of the simple answer, it's pretty straightforward. During my field work, I very often I hang out with my informants on the streets of settlements along the Pamir Highway, in particular Murghab, which is a town along this road in eastern Tajikistan, not far from the border with Afghanistan and China. And with my informants, I would sit on benches in front of the house, or we would stroll through the bazaar. And then during prayer time, especially towards the evening, one could hear the azan, which is the Islamic call for prayer, which emerged very often from the main mosque. And in these moments, the landscape in these places along the highway really looks extremely serene, but also surreal. And I say surreal here because the environment of the eastern Pamirs, where this highway is located, is extremely barren, it's extremely dry, and it gives one an almost lunar feeling. And of course, this could be first seen as an outsider perspective that I come with as an anthropologist. But the interesting point is that many of my informants related to this this take on this lunar landscape, and they joke themselves about living on the moon, very far away from the rest of humankind in one way or the other, but at the same time also very strongly connected in a global perspective. Now, the more complex answer I write about in the book in quite a bit of detail at the very beginning, where I open with an ethnographic vignette. And there I describe how during my fieldwork I came sort of across a range of different Islamic conversion narratives, which are usually published in popular booklets. But more recently, and this happened mostly towards the end of my fieldwork, were also shared via mobile phones. Now, one of the central narratives that I encountered during my fieldwork argues that the American astronaut Neil Armstrong, who was the first man on the moon, he converted to Islam after he realized that he had heard the azan, the Islamic call to prayer, when he stepped first on the moon. Now, for my informants, this is a really wonderfully resonating narrative because it relates to their own lunar landscape that they live in. It relates to the rise of public performances of piety along the Pamir Highway, especially since the end of the Soviet Union. And it really also speaks to the way people in the region have been socialized into a world of technology, something that is not very often acknowledged when people talk about this region that is usually considered remote. Many people in the region are mechanics, they're engineers, they're road constructors, they're scientifically trained. And for these people, the idea is very appealing that with the finest modern technology, which allows humans to fly to the moon, to build highways, such as the one in the Pamirs, all these technological means eventually lead back to God. And that's sort of a very powerful narrative that I start the book with. And when I was writing the book, I thought that this narrative needed to stand at the forefront because it gives a nice entry into the different topics that the book is defined by, but it also somehow links different worlds. And I thought an audience, especially an English speaking audience, might be able to more easily relate to the topics in this book if they see something that also relates to their own cultural background, such as the moon landing. Now, in terms of the topics that come in, if we think about the conversion narrative of Neil Armstrong, it's of course piety, it's contested ideas of tradition, of how humankind should sort of live together, sociality, a global outlook, but then of course, as I mentioned, technology, ideas of modernity, remoteness, but also peacefulness, which is an important topic in the region as well. And then the final step when it came to the production of the book, I somewhat realized that the title could also appeal to a much broader Muslim public, which I didn't think so much about when I came across these conversion narratives. I always saw them as something more local. But after my PhD, I moved as a postdoc to Singapore, where I also finalized my book manuscript at the National University of Singapore. And there, Malay Muslims could immediately connect to the book and the book title because they actually knew about Neil Armstrong's alleged conversion, as people along the highway did.
That's pretty fascinating that that story, you know, reaches into that area of the world. It's really telling. So how did you find yourself in the Pamir region? You talk about it as a little bit of a lunar landscape. How does one find themselves in this landscape if you are not a person from this region?
Well, I had a gradual entry into this region. And I think the first time I read about the Pamirs and the Eastern Pamirs in particular, that I focus on in the book, that was probably around 15 years back during my undergraduate studies at the University of Vienna. Back then, I read a lot about Kyrgyz because I studied Kyrgyz language in Vienna in the context of Oriental studies. And I read a lot about the Kyrgyz of the Eastern Pamirs in Tajikistan as well. There wasn't much academic literature, but there was quite a bit of popular literature. And I was really fascinated by what I read. And I always thought this in one way or the other. I didn't have a defined idea yet of what I wanted to do, but I thought this could be a good topic for research at one point. And what also really struck me is that back then, very few people who researched Kyrgyz communities looked much beyond Kyrgyzstan itself. And I realized that essentially nothing had been done on people living along this highway, the Pamir Highway. And then I finished my studies in Vienna. I didn't pursue any research in Tajikistan at that point, but I got the opportunity to work for a project of the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation in Tajikistan in 2007. And that was a wonderful opportunity for me. Living in Tajikistan enabled me to travel to the Pamirs, and I was really lucky to meet very different people from the region. Kyrgyz, on the one hand, who are minority in the Pamirs at large, but they're strongly represented along the highway and in the eastern Pamirs in particular. But I also met lots of Pamiris who are the majority in the Pamirs, and they offered me incredible insights into the complexity of the area. And then a little later, after I completed my work in Tajikistan, I got the chance to enter a doctoral program at the University of Bern in Switzerland. And at that point, it was clear to me that I wanted to write about the Pamirs, even though I did not yet know that my focus would be on that road. So the actual topic of the book in the context of the region, we talk about the social life of infrastructure and related ideas of modernity. They developed when I really lived along the Pamir Highway from around 2008. It wasn't it wasn't a constant, it was a back and forth, and that probably also informed my methodology. I had to teach back in Switzerland, and I could come for extended periods of time and live with people along the Pamir Highway, and it was a rough life. It's definitely rough because these days there's not much electricity. Water supply is restricted. It's thin air, so one has to get accustomed to thin air, like in any high altitude environment. And if one comes as an outsider, one certainly has to be prepared for very environmentally very rough winter conditions and high altitude conditions. But I should also say that if I compare myself with PhD students I observe now, I interact with at the institution I work with in Geneva, and they actually travel to the Afghan parts of the Pamirs and live there, where there are very few roads and where one has to walk for days to reach settlements, and where there's no electricity at all at times, I was probably in a pretty luxurious situation in that context. Now, the bulk of my research was really kind of traveling back and forth between the city of Osh in southern Kyrgyzstan and the city of Kharok, which is at the Tajik-Afghan border. And one encounters linguistically a really interesting variety, and there's a lot of change if one travels along the Pamir Highway in cultural terms, because the Kyrgyz influence, Kyrgyz language, sort of extends around halfway along the Pamir Highway, and then at one point the linguistic landscape changes into Pamir languages, which are very distinct from what Kyrgyz speak. And differences are also established in terms of religious orientation. Most Kyrgyz are actually Sunni Muslims, and a majority of Pamiris who live along the Pamir Highway, they speak Pamir languages, but are also Shia Ismaili Muslims. And this creates very, very fascinating intercommunal dynamics that I also write about in the book. But my intention was really not to focus on questions of language, ethnicity, and religion in the first place, because at one point in my fieldwork, I noticed that my informants reasoned actually a lot more about questions such as the condition of the road, about their lack of infrastructure, the idea that state services were not accessible anymore. And they both in Pamiri and Kyrgyz context, people reasoned about how to live a good life, an ethical life amidst all these new technologies that they're facing, or that they are not accessible to them, and also in light of really increasing political pressure by the central government. And when I worked on turning my material, my data, into first a dissertation and later a book manuscript, I found that the lens of infrastructure and modernity provided me with a really good opportunity to, on the one hand, fruitfully link with what my informants sort of thought was relevant to their lives, which is not necessarily sort of the immediate difference in ethnic and linguistic terms in the region, but really sort of this overarching framework of infrastructure and modernity. And I could link these conversations with my informants also with ongoing debates in anthropology, which was very helpful when structuring the book.
And so getting into the heart of the book, and in your early chapters, you kind of discuss the relevance of modernity in terms of the region and how modernity has multiple meanings in this region. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you explore that?
Well, debates about modernity are still quite frequently informed by an underlying assumption that modern places and people can mostly be found in urban centers or in the proximity of urban centers, of economic hubs, and perhaps seats of political power. And this is certainly, historically, this has been very strong, the case for debates in the West. But my work and life experience in places like Singapore and Hong Kong have really also shown me that this is also increasingly the case in Asian contexts, perhaps also in the Middle East, where we can observe the accumulation of wealth, which gives completely new rise to completely new ideas of the city. And the places that I researched are not urban in the classical sense of the term. So thinking about modernity there has very specific implications that I would like to talk about a little bit. Of course, there are very good reasons to think about modernity as being linked to the city in many ways, because if one comes with an institutional definition of modernity that is strongly linked to capitalism, then I guess this choice also makes a lot of sense in sociology and history. But there is always the question, and that's a question that arises in my book, what about all the historical and contemporary settings, such as places along the Palmyra Highway, that we need to ignore if we sort of come with this definition, a normative definition of modernity? And in Azan on the Moon, I try to approach modernity sort of coming from a perspective that attempts to perhaps avoid this assumption a little bit, and to try to disentangle modernity and this idea of capitalist accumulation to some extent. And in this, I follow a sociologist, which I'm quite fond of, Göran Terborn, who really suggests looking at modernity as consisting of specific time orientations. And this is an idea that I try to put forward in the book to some extent. Terborn talks about time orientations that are, on the one hand, expressed in specific social settings. And they, in this regard, they surface in competing master narratives about modernity, which form what he calls entanglements. And these can be locally very specific, but, and that's something I observe in my book and write about it, they're also, most of the time, also linked to really processes on a global scale and much broader ideas of modernity. And I would argue that the Neil Armstrong story already stands for such connections. And therefore, it also provides ground to actually connect different audiences, precisely because it is in many ways locally specific, but it is a way to also speak possibly to an American or a European audience. Now, why is this all important for the study of the Palmyra Highway? One could ask. And people in the region that I studied, they do look back to very large-scale modernization projects in the Soviet Union, of which the highway itself is sort of one of the central examples. It's a highway that we should not imagine as sort of a highway probably in the United States, but also in Europe we would find very different types of roads that are defined as highway. It's a paved road. It's not always in good condition, but it does the job of connecting people in this region to surrounding regions, and that's the most important feature of this road. And it's a road that was constructed back in the 1930s. That's at least when the construction began. But it really remained a very important project of modernization, a prestige project, I'd say, until the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And when people look back and they think about the development of the road and what it means to their lives, it is not just the materiality of the road that matters here. It's the memory of state provisioning in the Soviet Union that was very important. It is the idea of welfare services that framed people's lives. And these services were embedded in a political discourse in the Soviet Union that clearly depicted people along this highway as modern citizens of the Soviet Union who were on a par with the inhabitants of larger cities in this political context. And if we look at the contemporary life along the highway, we see contrast. Contemporary life along the highway is marked by a sense of being in the margins of Tajikistan as a state. And that's not only a territorial marginality, it's a politically and socially important form of marginality that clearly has implication for people's livelihoods as well. And then we look at different actors who emerge, NGOs, religious reformists, nationalists, local scholars, and all these actors, they offer people along the highway a range of alternative promises. They promise them to reconnect them to the modern Soviet past. They promise them to leave behind this past, or they promise them a completely new and bright future that is again defined by modernity. And if we talk about especially religious reformists, they often strive towards a type of modernity that is in many ways perfected by religious tradition. And we should always sort of see these processes as happening within a sort of a very specific context of marginality. And here we mostly talk about ongoing processes of economic and political exclusion. So modernity is really the guiding theme for the book, with all its different aspects, political, cultural, material, etc. But in order to kind of keep the book readable and not to repeat myself, I decided to focus on a few topics which I believe highlight these dynamics very clearly in the case of the Pamir Highway. And therefore, I particularly focus on identity in the first place. I talk about Islam, also reconnecting to sort of one of my fundamental research interests over the past decade. And I focus on ideas of the state and what the state's role in the establishment of modernity is.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And your stories from the field, your informants, the way you highlight them in your work, it's very interesting. And I think it really does draw the reader in and highlight all of those things that you want to discuss. So I was really drawn to the story about swaddling babies. So you have Alisher and Nursultan, and they're talking about swaddling a baby. Can you talk to us about that whole episode and how that kind of connects to your ideas of identity and modernity?
Yeah, so The ethnographic setting that you're referring to is that I lived in a house, and this house was, the people living in this house were connected to many other places along the highway, and I sort of got into a situation where two friends who hadn't seen each other for a long time, they came together. One was the host and the other one was coming from a different place along the highway, and both of them are fathers and both of them have babies at that point in time, and they discuss whether babies should be swaddled or they shouldn't, and both of these men had their particular ideas of whether swaddling is should be considered modern or not, and whether it's something that is appropriate to do. Maybe not, unlike people in many other places around the world discuss these questions based on particular ideologies and strands of thought they come from with their personal backgrounds. The interesting sort of point is that at one moment in the encounter, it becomes clear that for one man who is a Kyrgyz in Murghab, a very well-educated, respected man in the community, sort of takes the stance that babies should be swaddled because they shouldn't be given too much freedom. It would be bad for them. But the interesting point is that this is a man who considers himself as extremely modern, and the whole family that I've lived with, they sort of stand for this whole discourse in a much broader sense, because they try to embody modern ideals on a daily basis, and they're very thorough about this. And at the same time, they see modernity as something that always has to go hand in hand with traditions that are being locally reproduced and passed on from one generation to the other. And the swaddling is one of these questions. Now, the other man who comes in this interaction is a Pamiri who comes from Kharok, who stands in close connection to NGOs who in recent years promoted that babies shouldn't be swaddled in this area, and that instead they should be given freedom, that they should be able to move, which would potentially help their development as children, from babies to toddlers, etc. And he was in this interaction thoroughly convinced that the way he sort of brings up his children is thoroughly modern, and is the only way to go, really, if one wants to sort of achieve a particular type of modernity. And of course, these thoughts come from sort of particular influences from NGOs, but these NGOs are locally very, very rooted, because they're Islamically inspired NGOs that I'm happy to talk about in more detail later, and they kind of combine a type of modernity that tries to sort of weave in Islamically inspired values with liberalism, and that's where the idea that non-swaddling is the way to go actually comes from. So what we see is that on both sides, we have extremely complex, what I call entanglements, or what Goran Terron probably would call entanglements of modernity, which are very difficult to kind of trace back to one particular genealogy. And in this sense, they also challenge the idea that there is sort of one emanating source of modernity that is being globally distributed, but that these are actually local processes, and that we have to look at local contexts that relate to much broader discourses of modernity as they develop.
And thinking about the the Islamic NGOs, and you discuss how the reform of Islam along the highway is a critical part of the understanding of modernity and perfecting modernity. Do you see this discussion between Alisher and Nur-Sultan as an example of that kind of reforming of Islam and its connection to modernity?
Absolutely. It's definitely connected to reform ideas in very, very different contexts. And let me take this from a different perspective. I think I just ran myself into sort of a one-way street. If we talk about Alisher in this particular context and the ideas of modernity that come in there, we see sort of not only the liberal strand of thought that is prominent in there, but also the influence of Islamically defined development discourses that have come to the Palmyras in the course of the past two decades. And in this regard, the fact that Alisher himself is an Ismaili is extremely important. Ismailism is a religion that belongs to the Shia branch of Islam, and it is tied to the Aga Khan, who is a hugely influential figure in much of the Palmyras. Many people, as I pointed out earlier, in the Palmyras are Ismaili Muslims, and the Aga Khan is the contemporary Ismaili imam who stands in a long line of succession, which leads back to the Prophet Muhammad eventually. Now, if we want to understand what role these institutions that the Aga Khan brought to the Palmyras in the 1990s, we certainly have to look at the broader region and the history of Ismailism in this broader region. It's pretty difficult to understand what is going on in Tajikistan without having sort of a broader outlook that goes beyond former Cold War boundaries. Now, there's plenty of Ismailis also living in the bordering territories of Tajikistan, in Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan. And historically, there's been lots of interactions from this area towards British India back in the early 20th century, also in the 19th century. And developmental connections, ideas of modernity actually have already penetrated the area through this connection to Bombay and British India. But obviously, for the case of the for the Tajik Palmyras, this connection was not existing during the Soviet time, because Soviets prohibited these sorts of interactions, and they were not interested in allowing their citizens contact to their spiritual leader, who was actually very loyal to the British Empire. But the important part of the story, in order to understand an interaction such as the one between Alisher and Nur-Sultan, is that at the end of the Cold War in 1992, which was an enormously bloody civil war that at that time emerged in Tajikistan, the Palmyras were on the brink of a famine. And without the intervention of the Aga Khan Development Network, the Aga Khan Foundation in particular, there probably would have been a humanitarian catastrophe in the area. And based on this large-scale humanitarian intervention that came into this particular historical situation of eastern Tajikistan, a lot of development projects emerged sort of in the aftermath of that humanitarian intervention. And as soon as the initial humanitarian crisis was over, there were on the one hand infrastructural project, educational projects, healthcare projects, but also religious administration that brought religious reform to the Pamirs. And that's sort of the context we're talking about when we talk about reform movements in Islamic terms on the side of the Pamiris. If we talk about the Kyrgyz and in particular Sunni Muslims along the Pamir Highway, the case is probably even more complex because there's no kind of large-scale institutions that Kyrgyz could turn to for the search of answers in an incredibly confusing situation for many people when it comes to religious education, but also when it comes to developmental discourse. And in this regard, it perhaps makes sense to look at one of the kind of slightly larger movements that have been active in the area over the past decade. One of them, and this is one I talk about in the book in quite detail because it is of high political significance, is the Tablighi Jamaat, which is a transnational Islamic reform movement, which again, and that's a really interesting fact actually, also emerged under British colonial rule in India and gives people in Central Asia this kind of outlook that is rarely talked about in terms of Central and South Asia connections. The Tablighi Jamaat is a really globally active movement. It's active in promoting a socially conservative version of Islam. And it's a version of Islam that very often appeals also in particular to Sunni Muslims. So Kyrgyz along the Pamir Highway are have been drawn into sort of content purported by the Tablighi Jamaat very strongly. And this is something that has to do with the broader Central Asian context where the Tablighi Jamaat has been active for at least two decades, if not earlier. And it has been particularly successful in Kyrgyzstan. So the connection here is influence coming from Kyrgyzstan. So people, when I conducted research along the highway, starting from 2008, initially, Kyrgyz were extremely enthusiastic about this reform movement. And many of my friends, many of my informants, they joined preaching tours of the Tablighi Jamaat. It seemed like a really attractive thing to do. Young men grew long beards, they prayed, they stopped drinking. Young women began to wear their hijab, and people participated in peer groups for religious education. So it's certainly a lot of the ideas that are still circling around in the area are very much based on this influence because it was large scale in terms of how many people participated in Tablighi activities in one way or the other. Now, what happened is that shortly after I started my fieldwork, the government of Tajikistan actually abolished the movement, and they claimed that Tablighi members were literally non-modern terrorists, and they stigmatized Tablighi members. And Kyrgyz in the region largely bought this argument from the government, often in order not to get into troubles, but also because kind of the momentum got past it. It became clear that the ideas that Tablighi Jamaat promoted were sort of great to motivate people to go out and talk about reform ideas, about what religious activities should look like in the region, but there was no real funding behind it, and it was something that couldn't be sustainable in the long run. We're now at a situation where people, again, they look for very different sources, for various sources. We can look at the booklets that that sort of is important when we talk about the Neil Armstrong story. Sort of people really read literature and try to learn from these booklets how to make sense of their current situation and of Islam as a whole. But in broad, if we compare the situation sort of between the Pamiris, who are tied to very powerful transnational development institutions as well as religious administration, to the situation of the Kyrgyz, who are sort of orienting towards a much more diverse and very often confusing landscape. These are certainly the main differences that again come in into situations and encounters such as the one between Nur Sultan and Ali Sher.
And so thinking about the amount of, so you're talking about the NGOs who are coming in and sort of these outside religious forces that are influencing these, the people along the Pamir Highway. How does that connect to what you touch upon in chapter 5, the idea of marginality and the relationship to the state and how that shapes their ideas of modernity?
Yes, yeah, so in there is clearly a juxtaposition here between the Soviet experience, which especially the late Soviet experience, which I guess was for many people one of a strong state, was a state that provided services, and it provided a relatively coherent framework in ideological terms, but also in terms of security. And I guess the Tajik civil war, in particular, led to really sort of a radical break with this idea of what the state can provide. It led to different ideas of the state, of state services, and of how people assessed political rule as something that suddenly is subject to constant change. So the central point that I make in this chapter is that people don't really take the state's modernity as granted anymore. And this is something that causes irritation along the Pamir Highway, because the historical experience, at least for the later Soviet period, was that strong state services and a particular representation of modernity on the side of the state could be taken for granted, and this is juxtaposed with the image of a state as a rather complex and chaotic endeavor, which is again confusing. Now, marginality comes in here through a range of different strategies by the state to position the Pamirs within the national framework. For instance, I talk about language policies as one example for such processes. I think what is maybe a particularly good example is that people along the Pamir Highway have been using Russian as a language of administration for many, many decades. Many people are very proficient in Russian, and they also attribute a sense of real global importance to the language. It's a language that links them to a broader world beyond Tajikistan. Now, a few years ago, the Tajik government implemented, I would say, a rather hasty law that eventually made Tajik the sole language of administration. And this, as a result, turned a large number of very qualified and experienced official really into functional illiterates. These people ceased to understand new laws that were issued. They ceased to understand regulations that came from Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan. And they had to pay huge fines for submitting their reports in any other language than Tajik. And most people still submitted their reports in Russian because they couldn't write them in Tajik. And this really created enormous costs because either they had to pay fines or they had to find translators who could understand and issue documents. And this is a problem really also for ordinary citizens in their interaction with state institutions, especially when we talk about paper interaction with state institutions. Because of course, local officials are still proficient in local languages, but the way documents have to be submitted and documents are issued is basically happening in a language that people don't understand anymore. And this creates a sense of being in the state's margins, not only in an administrative sense, but really also if we talk about education, if we talk about access to state jobs, if we talk about the possibility to actually participate in the political process in the capital, etc. So these are the political side of things if we talk about marginality. Another example that I discuss in the book and that I think is it's actually really, really important, especially at this point in time, is trade with China. Trade with China has absorbed the Tajik economy really enormously and to a large extent over the past decade. We have a huge percentage of the state budget is based on this income, and we also see that the political elite makes a lot of money out of these trade connections. But we also see that people in the Pamirs who literally live at the Chinese borders are pretty much excluded from these opportunities by a set of regulations implemented by state institutions. For instance, people along the highway find it extremely difficult to do cross-border trade because of visa regulations that really forces them to travel to the capital, which is 1,000 kilometers on very bumpy roads, expensive roads to the west, and fly into China instead of being able to cross into China from their border towns. Now, for people along the highway, this situation has really contributed also to their image of the state as somewhat backwards, as a kind of a trading enterprise that really doesn't involve them much. And it is also something that probably ties in with Soviet discourses at this point in time, because individual trade was, of course, highly stigmatized in the Soviet era. And for people along the Pamir Highway, this is an assessment that is still resonates, is still valid. It seems something that you shouldn't do if you're an honest citizen. Now, obviously, this assessment has also to do with the fact that they actually cannot participate in the most profitable trade-related activities with China. Now, instead, what they do in this situation is that they often have to import basic everyday necessities from the city of Osh in southern Kyrgyzstan. And these necessities, these goods, they also come from China, but they're imported from China to Kyrgyzstan and then sort of brought with via petty trade to places along the Pamir Highway, making these goods enormously more expensive than direct imports from China. So if we talk about marginality here, we see economic marginalization at play. And as connections with trade connections and other investments become stronger between Tajikistan and China, this is, of course, a question that is of really high importance to the people along the highway. And for them, there has to be a solution at one point in order to participate in these activities and not get sidelined. And it is a kind of, if we talk about marginality and the state here, the result of these processes is that narratives of political rule in Tajikistan, as sort of seen locally, is they're narratives of an incapable, really non-modern state with a chaotic despot as its rulers. And that's essentially sort of the way people very often express it these days. And this is an image that is often juxtaposed with sort of the yearning for an ideal, benevolent, strongman president, which isn't there at this point in time.
Well, Till, thank you so much for being on the show today. I think we learned a lot about Azan on the Moon and the fascinating Pamir region. So I have to ask you the famous last question of the New Books Network. What are you working on now?
Yeah, so I probably talked already a little bit about newer things that aren't all in the book. So during my research in the Pamirs, I did not only come into touch with NGOs, which are globally organized. I also came across cross-border relations to neighboring countries. And as I mentioned, I started to research in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and China. And there are really plenty of under-researched historical and contemporary connections between the Tajik Pamirs and what I sort of vaguely describe as Greater Badakhshan, which includes smaller parts of Afghanistan, China, and then a much larger region in northern Pakistan. So in 2012, I began fieldwork in Pakistan on these issues. So I moved southwards from Central Asia a little bit. And what I do in my ongoing research project is that I look at these connections in particular through the prism of charitable and humanitarian institutions that have emerged from Muslim networks in the course of the 20th century. I've talked about Aga Khan institutions in this regard, which are, of course, very important for Tajikistan and also other places in Central Asia. Especially in Kyrgyzstan, there's also large-scale investments going on there. So I've mentioned them, but there are also other Muslim institutions that I think are very important to understand how the broader region has been shaped in terms of social and physical landscapes and through infrastructure investments, healthcare projects, educational mobility, etc. And I think it's a good moment in time to research these questions because, as I previously mentioned, there is a lot of talk about Chinese investments in the region and how they're going to change the area, not only Tajikistan, but the other mentioned places as well. And what I would like to pursue with my current project is that I would like to look at these processes through the lens of locally grounded institutions and their visions of humanitarianism, of development, of how life in the region should be lived, how society should be structured. And there's a long, long social history behind this, and I really plan to write about, largely unknown institutions and individuals that really have pursued links between Central and South Asia, but also to other places in Asia, in Europe and the Middle East for a very long time.
Well, that sounds like a really interesting project, and I know we can't wait to read about it. So, Till, thank you for being with us today, and take care.